From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The latest story making headlines about the tycoon Rupert Murdoch is the phone hacking scandal in the United Kingdom, where a number of Murdoch's senior executives are facing charges of criminality. The reporter David Folkenflik says if you're going to understand that story, or really any story about Murdoch and his media empire, you need some context. In his new book, Murdoch's World, Folkenflik says you have to understand the history of the company. You have to understand the complicated dynamics of the Murdoch family. And you have to understand Australia, both as an idea and as a culture. Folkenflik is NPR's media correspondent, and today in the program he's joining us to talk about Murdoch's world and the philosophy at its core. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Things haven't really gone so well for the media tycoon Rupert Murdoch over the last few years. As a result of the phone hacking scandal in the United Kingdom, Murdoch was forced to split his companies. The culture he had cultivated in his empire over the course of six decades and the philosophy that drove it all had raised questions about his integrity. It had strained his relationship with his mother. It alienated his kids. Doesn't seem to have hurt the bottom line much, though. NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik has been covering the phone hacking story, but he says if you're going to truly understand the context for this story, you have to know the deeper story of Rupert Murdoch, the history of his family, his relationship with his children, and Australia. You have to understand Australia, because Folkenflik says that for Rupert Murdoch, the idea of Australia serves as a source of his strength, and maybe it's a key to making sense of the culture in his empire. David Folkenflik is joining us today to talk about his new book. It's called Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. This is his first book. He's joining us today from NPR's studios in New York City. And David Folkenflik, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Doug. I'm excited.
Well, I wanted to start with, I guess, the it's one thing to cover Rupert Murdoch's empire as a series of stories. It's one thing to cover the hacking scandal, you know, for NPR. It's another thing to put it all together and, you know, to develop things and write a book. At what point did you figure, I think I need to write a book to understand this? I mean, what was the point where you transferred from just covering it as a story as to creating it as a book?
You know, I talked about doing a story, a book on cable news as far back as, call it 2011 with my publisher. And I just wasn't quite clear whether I've been covering media since 2000, but I wasn't quite clear precisely the story I wanted to tell. And then two folks emerged to say they were doing books on Fox, which, you know, in some ways is the most interesting of the three to tell a story about. And I just wasn't clear that was going to be useful. But as the hacking story emerged in the summer of 2011, I just sort of stopped thinking about it and thought, this is a very interesting story with implications at the highest levels, both of media, commerce, of course, but politics in Britain, law enforcement. And, you know, at the top of that was the guy who had seemingly been untouchable, Rupert Murdoch. And I wanted to understand what the heck happened there. And it struck me as very likely that this wasn't going to be purely a British story. And I think that even though obviously it's an obsession there and more of an interest here, I think that's proven to be basically correct. Mm.
Did you have you must have had a sense of what you were up against. I mean, reporting on the Murdoch empire, I'm sure you realized was pretty dicey, certainly from some of your past experiences, which we'll get to.
Sure. Well, look, the Murdochs don't embrace coverage. They felt burned by a book that came out in, call it, late 2008 by Michael Wolff, a very stylish magazine writer who had ingratiated himself to the Murdochs in part because of his fascination with power and money and billionaires. And had spent a lot of time with them and got them on tape saying things that ultimately they felt a little embarrassed about coming out in public. So, you know, the Murdochs weren't desperate to go through that again. Secondly, you know, this was happening amid these great legal investigations that have led to some pretty significant prosecutions over there in the UK. And so there are legal reasons why they don't want to be on the record saying more than they have to about this stuff. And, you know, thirdly, they're a media company that more than almost any in American contemporary culture, you know, uses their outlets as vehicles to punish people who they're not feeling good about, yeah. Whether they are people they oppose ideologically and politically, whether they are competitors or whether they are people who are criticizing mm-hmm. them. And so these are all things that come into play. On the plus side, you know, I've now been covering media since, as I said, 2000. And I've done a lot of the reporting already on certain elements of the story that helped me put things into place. And that made, you know, those are things they can't take away. Mm-hmm. In addition, the investigations in the UK laid bare and revealed a ton of things about what's happening, you know, out of public view that, you know, it's a real lens to seeing how things work really when there's money and power and prestige at stake among the top levels of the Murdoch news empire in a way that was invaluable to writing the book. And the third thing is, you know, you got to plug away, you know, as a reporter, mm-hmm. when a door's closed in your face, you keep knocking, you keep calling and you explain. And sometimes people were very patient and decent about explaining things. You know, people who have known the Murdochs for decades, worked with them closely or worked for them.
Did it surprise you how much Australia came into play in this story, the idea of Australia, as you put it in the book?
Well, I think you've captured it very nicely about the idea of Australia. You know, Murdoch is based – I'm talking to you now from Midtown Manhattan, you know, overlooking Bryant Park on West 42nd Street. And, you know, the Murdochs' world empire is based about five blocks away up 6th Avenue. And people think of him as Australian in this country, but he's been an American citizen for almost 30 years now,
right.
In part because he needed to be able to claim American citizenship so that he could expand and hold on to television holdings and the network that he envisioned to challenge the big three networks in this country. You know, he goes back to Australia, though, and he says, we need to do this. He says, this can be our century here in Australia. This is the Australian characteristic. And he really feels so fundamentally his worldview is so shaped by being an Australian, the idea that you're a bit of a buccaneer, that you're outside of the sort of prim and prissy establishments that he sees in London and in some ways in the U.S., that Australia, you know, shares certain kinds of sensibility with the U.S. and that, you know, cowboys are kind of celebrated and that they see themselves as a less class-ridden society. But he really noticed class distinctions and nurtured what he felt were grievances or what were essentially his grievance against the establishment that he felt was not welcoming enough to his father. And, you know, I want to be clear, there's a kind of amazing element of this where, you know, you've got a guy who's the son of a wealthy newspaper executive. Mm-hmm. His father was a knight, you know, knighted by the British crown. And, you know, he's left an entire newspaper. You or I might think that's a pretty wealthy, privileged guy. He thought, gosh, my father has been cheated out of other holdings. Mm-hmm. He was never quite given the full amount of respect he was due because other guys saw him just as an executive and not as an owner. And as an Australian who then migrated to London to expand his base to see, you know, greater vistas and greater riches, he felt that as an Australian he was repeatedly patronized or dismissed as a serious player by Brits who, you know, thought, well, he wasn't of the right stock. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, here's a guy who's the son of a knight who went to Oxford University right. in England, but he feels that he's being held at arm's length because he's not establishment enough. And this plays out again and again and again, this sense of being an outsider, being held at arm's length, even as he's ingratiated himself to such a place where he controls so much of the newspaper market in the UK that prime ministers are beseeching his attention both from Australia and the UK.
David, explain how Rupert Murdoch thinks about his role in terms of being a steward of a public trust, owning a media empire. I mean, you write about this is how several of the leading newspaper families in the United States, for example, think about or have thought about their role. You know, that this is something bigger than just making money. But,
sure.
But Rupert Murdoch doesn't seem to see it in that way.
Well, he does. He does and he doesn't. I mean, you think of Jeff Bezos buying the Washington Post, and there were these incredible celebrations of Donald Graham, you know, the sort of last chairman from the combined Meyer and Graham families who had owned the newspaper for a century – or excuse me, for 80 years, since 1933, and had said, you know, this is a – we want this to be a profitable enterprise, but more, we want this to be something that provides a check on power and provides a public service and, you know, holds our institutions accountable to the public. And that's, you know, how the Sulzbergers here in New York at the New York Times, that's how many other sort of great newspaper families looked at their job. It was not to serve a partisan interest, even if you could, you know, define a point of view on its editorials that was pretty reliable. It was about the idea that there were these powerful people you had to hold accountable. That's how they looked at public service. Mm-hmm. Rupert Murdoch in 1989 gives what's called the McTaggart Address, which is the biggest public talk, call it, in British broadcasting industry every year. It's up in Scotland. And he goes up in 1989 and he says – and he's talking about television here, but I think the words carry for his point of view more generally. He says, any service that you provide to the public within the law that the public is willing to pay for is a public service.
Right.
Now, you know, that would suggest that roller coasters are a public service. Mm-hmm. You know, it would suggest selling cotton candy is a public service. It would suggest, you know, a whole bunch of things are a public service rather than commerce. And it's a very different construct than most American, you know, family newspaper owners would offer for you. You know, in Britain, of course, the problem is that it seems as though a sizable minority of his journalists seem to have forgotten the within the law part.
Right, right.
But regardless of that, you know, if the New York Post shows girls in bikinis and the Sun, the top selling newspaper in England owned by Murdoch, has topless girls on page three, and that's what the public shows it wants by buying those newspapers and in focus groups explaining they don't want those to go away even in perhaps a more gender-enlightened age, then that's what he's going to do, even if that's not what he wants his youngest daughters to see at the breakfast table.
You quote one of his former editors, Simon Jenkins, who said that he found American newspapers to be boring and biblical. And you say that Murdoch's editors called these kinds of papers, like the New York Times, I guess like the Washington Post, the unpopular press.
Yeah, they were very denigrating and dismissive toward it. You know, Murdoch, in all of these three great, you know, English-speaking nations in which he is such a presence and such an influence, Australia, the UK, the US, he plays a high-low game. And that is, he has these tabloids that reach mass audiences. And he also has these prestigious papers. He created The Australian in 1964. It's the only general interest daily newspaper for the country. It's a modest circulation, but it essentially is read by every thought leader, political figure, you know, a corporate baron. They all want to sort of know what the great issues of the day are going to be. And then by doing that, by playing that role, The Australian helps to shape not only what the great issues are, but how people think about it. In London, he bought the Times of London, perhaps the best known publication in the English language, or at least for a long time, and the Sunday Times, its sister paper, 1981. And that allowed him to supplement the Sun and the News of the World, which he had made into the most successful and widest circulation daily and Sunday papers, respectively. So it meant that he had both the biggest circulation dailies and the biggest, you know, thought leader newspapers. He controlled 40% of national newspaper circulation in what is essentially a national newspaper market. And what that meant was politicians had to pay close attention. But under oath, he was asked, well, you know, how do we know what you think? And he said, if you want to know what I think, you can read The Sun every day,
right,
the tabloid every day. And that pretty much holds true for The New York Post as well. Well, what he's saying is essentially he owns the high, you know, more respected newspapers and he owns the tabloids. But the tabloids are where he feels you connect with the people. He feels they're operated, you know, they really reflect his somewhat right of center, center right, populist, kind of punching at elites, punching at the famous, snickering at politicians who are sort of automatically assumed to be crooks or philanderers, and often shown to be so, by the way.
Yeah.
And that he feels that's the sensibility that he shows these sort of sanctimonious elites like the Sulzbergers or like the other guys he was competing against in London, that he knows how a mass audience really feels. And that's where he is. That's who he is.
Yeah.
And that's why they look down at you know, the more respectable papers that might win the prizes from the Pulitzers as the unpopular press.
It was Murdoch's paper, The Sun, that published Prince Charles' infamous and intimate and kind of creepy telephone conversation with Camilla Parker Bowles. This was in 1989. And I think that story is interesting because you write about it in the book, because the paper really tested Murdoch's philosophy, this idea that, you know, if it provides a service which the public wants it at a price it can afford, then that's public service. And I guess they hold off printing the transcripts of those hacked now telephone conversations between Prince Charles and Camilla Parker Bowles at first. And then they ask readers, do you want to see these transcripts? And it turns out they do. And so they publish them. So in some ways, he's right. And this seems like a theme that you kind of come back to from time to time in the book, this idea that he's giving people what they want.
Yeah, he's creating a market for what they want.
Yeah.
And then he's giving it to them.
Right.
So, you know, he's implicated on both sides of the equation. And at the same time, you know, it's absolutely true that if we didn't seek this stuff out, he wouldn't be selling it. You know, I think there's a codicil to that, which is that The Sun was not quite so brazen as to do it on its own.
Right.
It first appeared mysteriously in an Australian publication, yeah. The transcript of these talks between Prince Charles and Camilla Parker Bowles, now his wife. And it appeared in an Australian publication, but, you know, what's usually only mentioned in passing was that it was a Murdoch Australian publication.
Right.
So his folks had it down there, apparently, but perhaps, you know, we're not clear. It does not seem likely that it was Australian journalists who did this. Now, at the time, 1989, if you think back, and I can remember, these were when people were starting to use cordless phones, but they were cordless phones that were essentially what we would now call unencrypted.
Yeah.
So what was described to me by a former tabloid reporter and editor for Murdoch was that they used to have a retired London taxi cab, if you can think of those sort of double-doored, you know, black cabs that you see in the movies. And they had kitted it out with various listening equipment to catch it on what's essentially a police scanner. So, you know, at the time that hadn't been outlawed yet, and I think there was a stretch during which that was not outlawed in this country as well. And so, you know, there are questions of expectations of privacy, but The Sun, you know, did the genteel thing of making sure it was not inflicting on its beloved readership anything it didn't want to know.
Right.
And then, you know, it publishes these things, but also, you know, this tabloid journalist was Paul McMullen was very scornful of the idea that the public was so outraged, because he said, look, we set up a line where listeners could call in and listen to the prince in his own voice.
Yeah.
And listen to the recordings. And, you know, you charged him, I think it was something like, you know, £1.95 or whatever it was to listen. You're like, and people were calling all day. So The Sun made money off it that way, too. So he says, you tell me. The public wanted it. How is it not the public? And the interesting thing is, you know, when I talked to McMullen, his definition of public service was anything the public was willing to pay for. And he had dropped that little codicil of that little dependent clause of within the law. And it just, you know, I think it was an unconscious thing on his part, but I thought also revealing.
David Folkenflik is with us. His book is Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. You can join us if you have questions or comments, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is with us. He's written a book that explores the world media tycoon Rupert Murdoch has created. It's called Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. You mentioned right before the break Paul McMullen, one of the former – he used to be a reporter for the News of the World. And I wanted to talk about what McMullen revealed to you about the way the Murdoch system seems to work. I mean, you write that editors – would scream at reporters, or worse, they would fire them if they didn't deliver on these leads. You mentioned how one reporter had fainted all of this pressure. Does this get to this idea of what they used to call, or maybe still do call, mate culture?
Well, it's they sort of operate in the same ecosystem, let's put it that way. It was a very hard-driving tabloid culture, you know, where the idea is and not badly reflected, by the way, in the movie The Paper with Glenn Close and Michael Keaton a couple decades ago. Yeah. A harder version of it, a tougher version. You know, you've got all these, you know, in Britain, you've got all these tabloids competing with each other, and they're all based in London, right? So they're all on top of each other. And also, if you think of London, it's a little bit like having Washington, D.C. and New York and Hollywood all in the same city. You've got fashion, you've got the movies, you've got politics. You've got money in the financial center, and they're all there, right there. So you have all these national tabloidy newspapers, and you have all these sort of targets, which is really how these guys are all viewed. And they're all right there. So yeah, paparazzi are just sort of fanning the city to find people and to take pictures and to sort of cause trouble. But the reporters go out with, you know, it's so much of an emphasis on, is somebody behaving badly in public? Is somebody else cheating on their spouse? One reporter described how reporters would hole up in vans, and they were basically looking to see if, you know, this soccer player or that politician would climb out of his girlfriend's apartment at 5 or 6 in the morning so they could snap pictures and accost him, whatever. But they were so terrified of being screamed at by their editors if they missed it. You know, they didn't want to take a bathroom break and head to the pub down the block and duck into the men's room. So they'd have these, you know, empty Gatorade bottles to urinate into, because they just were so fearful of missing anything for 5 minutes. And, you know, people would essentially, you know, some of them would take speed to stay up or, you know, other drugs, or maybe they just justified their lifestyle that way. But it was all kind of in the ether there. And the line between people, you know, observing bad behavior and people participating in it to be able to observe it, and then people participating in it to try to elicit that kind of bad behavior they could then cover, you know, was blurry at best. I mean, McMullen was essentially involved. He had been tipped off by a cop that the daughter of the very noted British actor Denham Elliot, you know, was basically begging for money at a tube stop, meaning a subway stop in London. And her father had left her some things, but she had fell on hard times. And, you know, the way he explained it to me was that he essentially set her up so that he could talk to her about it and take pictures of it. And, you know, it was a sad story that he talked about her addiction to exploit it. What he didn't tell me, and what I only found in sort of reviewing it further and when he testified about it later, was that he had essentially gotten her to agree to come to his apartment to take money for sex so that she could fund her addiction, and that he had basically procured that from him. It wasn't like she volunteered the idea. And, you know, that's a pretty rough game that you're playing. It's a pretty cruel sport, and yet it was seen as sport. The one thing I will say is that I think it's fair to say in the last 10 to 15 years, it's gotten fiercer, if anything, because of, you know, there are new sources of competition online from gossip sites like TMZ or Gawker or the equivalent in the UK. And also that just the revenues have been, you know, undercut. And this is not, you know, particularly specific to the Murdoch press at all. It's just the industry generally. You've seen subscribers and circulation go down, and you've seen advertising go down. Mm-hmm. So, you know, suddenly there's a feverish pitch every day. And in the UK, newspapers are much more than here sold on a daily basis. So it really is about what's on the cover of that newspaper. And it's it's a bit of a blood sport there.
Do you think that same idea of day to day, getting the story for the day, does that inform in some way and explain maybe the essence or part of the strategy of Fox News, for example? Because you write about Fox News that determining what they believe to be the story of the day is a really important strategy for Fox News.
No, I think it's there's definitely tabloid blood circulating in Fox News's veins. You know, it likes its women attractive and sleek. It likes its men confident and assured. It likes to have a sense of humor and sort of make fun of things and sort of have a jaunty tone. And at the same time, there's almost a bear-baiting element to some of what it does. Fox News is more conservative than Murdoch's tabloids generally are.
Yeah.
It's just more reliably conservative. Part of what Murdoch does with the tabloids is he – you know, they're definitely right of center. You know, you think of the New York Post and the Sun as good examples of that. But, you know, they will toggle back and forth between Democratic and Republican candidates in certain ways as a way in part of ensuring that they are still influential. That is, you know, if you're always going to support the Democrat for president, as the New York Times does, or for major offices with rare exception, you're not going to be able to necessarily shape as much how favorable they are toward you. As if you can go back and forth. Politicians of both parties on both sides of the Atlantic have been desperately seeking Murdoch's appeal for years. But Fox does have this tabloid sensibility, which is the sense of sport in both a benign and sort of a cruel way. Mm. And it also is perfectly willing to use its airwaves, just as the New York Post and the Sun are willing to use its pages, to further the business and personal interests of its leaders. And therefore, you know, Fox can come out swinging on things when Fox is mentioned. And sometimes Fox may have a point, as when the Obama administration tries to shut it out of certain kinds of meetings. And sometimes Fox is just trying to prove a point, as when it went after NPR in the wake of the Juan Williams thing. Mm-hmm. Not to say there aren't legitimate questions to explore, but that was not a journalistic endeavor by Fox News. It was a sort of a happy time for them to do essentially a marketing blitz on its airwaves by identifying an enemy and going after it.
There's a story in the book you write about how Fox handled, and I think it's instructive about sort of more broadly how they handle or react anyway when critical coverage. It's a story that you broke about the war coverage of Fox's Geraldo Rivera. This is when – I guess this is probably when you were working for The Sun.
That's correct.
Yeah, this is December of 2000, the Baltimore Sun. You were working there before NPR, and this was December 2001, so not long after, of course, the 9/11 attacks. And this story sort of I guess we should say it landed you on the blacklist at Fox.
Sure.
To tell that story.
Well, you know, Fox had always been a particularly contentious. They were in their PR department. It's an aggressive department. It reminded me – I used to cover Congress and politics for The Sun before becoming the media guy there. And it reminded me more of a political campaign. And as time went on, it became very evident that's really how they thought of themselves too, quite explicitly. So they were very upset with my coverage on Election Day 2000 when they had said that their election watcher and call guy, the person who gets to make the call on, you know, when a state flips and all that, you know, didn't really make the call that night. The reason that was important was that it was then Governor George W. Bush's first cousin, John Ellis, who was making those calls. They said he played no role. We had a young stringer by the decision desk who said that he had boasted to her of sort of saying, I'm the guy who's going to make the call tonight. Mm-hmm. So they were very upset with us and our coverage that night. Regardless, I did a story in December of 2001 about Geraldo Rivera, and he had told a very poignant, although singularly self-centered story about encountering this site where three American servicemen and a bunch of allied Afghan fighters had been killed in a friendly fire attack, that is, American bombs took out their own guys. And he had seen them and had been totally moved and had knelt and had prayed over the site. And he told this story twice over the course of 24 hours. Now, that bombing attack occurred in Kandahar, which is very much to the south of the country. Tora Bora is sort of well north and east of that, 300 miles, in fact, give or take. And so I called and talked to people in Tora Bora for the other networks. I talked to people at international humanitarian relief agencies. I talked to people at the Pentagon. I talked to as many people as I could. I said, is it remotely possible that he could have been in Tora Bora, filed a report, gotten down to Kandahar, found the site, prayed on it, and then come back and told that story from Tora Bora 300 miles again in a 24-hour period? And one after the other, people said just simply not possible. It's both too far and too dangerous. That the roads were just, you know, both in control of various rival Afghan warlords, and also that they were essentially patrolled by all these bandits and highwaymen, and it was just a really impossible trip. And it turned out he had prayed over nothing at all. And so, you know, Fox News was outraged that their chief war correspondent, who they essentially had turned into an action figure, you know, had who was considered close to Roger Ailes. He'd come to Fox News from CNBC, where Ailes used to be his boss there. And this was mortifying. It ended up being, translated into many dozens of languages across the world, and just making them a point of derision on the Saturday Night Live and the Daily Show and the rest. And so Fox for 15 months essentially said there was a policy that nobody at Fox News in any role could talk to me, period.
Right.
And I sort of at a certain point started incorporating that in my stories, which made them even more embarrassed.
Right.
At a certain point, you know, I got a call from Rob Zimmerman, who at that time was one of their PR guys. And he said, okay, it's been 15 months. You haven't changed your spots. You haven't pulled your punches. We kind of respect that. We're turning a new page. Let's move on. And I said, great. It wasn't personal, which was an important lesson. It was just they wanted me to know that they could pull anything I have for embarrassing them. And they, more to the point, they wanted other reporters to know there would be consequences for doing that too.
That is so interesting to me, because you say in the book, when you got married a few years later, that the Fox PR team sent you a really nice bottle of champagne, which of course you returned, but it seems revealing, though I'm not sure just about what. I mean, it seems like the mafia, that, you know, it's not personal, it's business.
That's an interesting comparison. And it was, by the way, an exquisite bottle of champagne. You know, I let it linger on the desk a little bit before I turned it back, just because I thought, oh, that's gorgeous, you know. And I think they look at it this way, you know, more than one of them had said, you know, if we were running a really top-line Senate campaign, or we were running an insurgent race for the presidency in the primaries, and we did this stuff, you guys would be writing pieces about us in Vanity Fair and Politico, praising our savvy and how smart and good we are. And the difference is, you know, Fox News, theoretically, news organizations aren't simply about winning. They're about news and about truth. And you know, this is really much more of a political unit that's appended to an organization that has news in its name. And, you know, there are other instances you turn up where they had engaged in really denigrating the character of a reporter, in another instance essentially deceiving him so he would publish false information. You know, and these are tricks that may be practiced on campaigns, although, you know, it's only in retrospect that people say, ah, those rascals, what a job they did. But you know, if that's attached to the New York Times or the Washington Post, people would be outraged, because those aren't consistent with the values of the newsroom. Fox is such a different beast that, you know, they effectively, you know, among other things, they felt they ran the shop.
Yeah.
That PR so reflected the sensibilities of Roger Ailes, whose conservatism is a source of fascination for people who love him and who criticize him, but whose real political sensibilities are revealed in a much more brawling, feuding style that's about the manner in which he does it, not just the content.
Well, you describe this, you know, you say the PR department sort of wiped the slate clean for you and said, okay, now you're off the blacklist. But then you encounter, you say, some 6 years after this, Roger Ailes at some event. And you mentioned it seems like he had kind of been brooding over your Geraldo Rivera story. He says to you, and I'll put it in kinder terms than he actually used, I remember who you are, David Folkenflik. You tried to screw us. It seemed like a kind of nasty sort of exchange, that it was in some ways maybe personal for Roger Ailes. Is that wrong?
Well, he's an excellent brooder.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's world class. His patron, Rupert Murdoch, you know, he knows how to nurse a grievance. The PR shop was making it clear it wasn't personal to them.
Yeah.
You know, Geraldo is somebody who Ailes, you know, rehabilitated at CNBC after all of his, you know, tabloid talk show days where he'd get in these fights with the Klansmen and, you know, have the, I don't know, you know, hermaphroditic strippers on and, you know, then bring their mothers out to sort of call them, you know, those kinds of shows. And you know, when I interviewed Geraldo for that original story in 2001, which they did under duress, Geraldo was once livid with me.
Yeah.
And, you know, has conducted a campaign for years. He originally tried to get me fired, and then he announced he wanted to meet me in an alley some way and beat me up, which I thought was hilarious because he came to my newspaper to try to get me fired, and, you know, I was only a couple hundred yards away. But in any event, you know, he's done this kind of brawling kind of thing, but he was also very self-aware of who he was, the voyage he'd taken as a journalist, sometimes in quotes, sometimes more legitimately as a journalist. And, you know, he was very aware of Geraldo the character. But this story really just took him out for a while. Mm. It just made him a laughing stock. And when he was in Iraq a year or so later, you know, he then sketched these lines in the sand
right.
where, you know, it was basically showing the Iraqis on CNN or MSNBC, wherever he was. Obviously, I guess it was on Fox, you know, where the supply lines were coming from. And so, you know, the U.S. military essentially said, you've got to get out of Iraq now. You know, this can't be sustained. And, you know, Ailes had nurtured him and made him back into a star, and this was a, you know, it wasn't an ideological hit job. It was a blow to his credibility. And so, you know, Ailes wants to be able to play both sides of that ledger where he's, you know, says he doesn't care about credibility from the mainstream press and actually, you know, when they attack him, cares about it a lot. He'd carried that for a long time. The fact that unprompted, I just sort of congratulated him on the launch of the Fox Business Network. I was at his party.
Yeah.
They're invited by his folks to celebrate his night. You know, the fact that that's what comes out of his mouth tells you a little bit about how he thinks.
David Folkenflik, NPR's media correspondent. His new book is called Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. We need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with NPR's media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're talking about his new book, Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. He's joining us from the studios of NPR in New York City. Well, let's talk about this phone hacking story. There's a story that you tell right at the beginning of the book that I want to have you talk about. This is, I guess, to set the scene. Rupert Murdoch is gathered with other people in this really expensive suite in a luxury hotel in the heart of London. As you describe him, of course, he's this powerful, influential man. He can be ruthless. But you describe him sitting there as really, at this moment anyway, is really human, even vulnerable. Tell the story, if you would.
Well, it's just days after the hacking scandal is broken into the open. On July 4th, 2011, The Guardian revealed that among the people whose phones had been hacked by people working on behalf of News in the World, and again, that was the best-selling Sunday paper in all of the U.K.,
yeah.
Was a girl named Millie Dowler, who's a 13-year-old who back in 2002 had been abducted and her body's remains were found 6 months later. But it turned out that her phone had been hacked into repeatedly and aggressively by people working on the newspaper's behalf. And this took the story of hacking from the realm of something that had been done to the princes, where two guys went to jail back in 2006, 2007. But, you know, police kept saying, well, you know, there's no evidence. This is just an isolated case. Don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. And then it turned out that, well, maybe a couple of figures in public life had been hacked into, a couple guys in the sports world. But it's still isolated. And then it turned out, you know, about 9 months earlier in late 2010, well, maybe Sienna Miller and Jude Law had been hacked into too. You know, but they're actors and maybe a couple politicians as well in early 2011. And you know, but politicians are seen as crooks and politicians are seen as philanderers and celebrities and sports players are seen essentially as fair game. Yeah. That phrase keeps coming up, the idea of every just thing being fair game. And then it's a dead 13-year-old girl and suddenly none of this seemed fair at all. Right. And all these political figures who had been for so many years laying the groundwork for so long to try desperately to get the support of the Murdoch papers and the Murdoch press that were so influential, suddenly we're running away from them with great rapidity. And the nation, in a rare moment, rose as one in revulsion. And so Rupert Murdoch returns to London to try to take a handle on this, which is seen, among other things, as a sign that his son James, who had been on a glide path to take over the entire empire sometime in the near future and was chairman of all their ventures in England, hadn't gotten the job done. And so Rupert Murdoch is in a suite in an upper floor of this very Tony hotel at the heart of London, not far from 10 Downing Street, where, you know, Saudi princes come and heads of state and celebrities come to stay. And he's there. It's just him. And it's an aide to him named Will Lewis, whom he had hired away. He had been the editor of the Telegraph newspaper. There was a lawyer there named Mark Lewis, no relation to William, and who was the lawyer for the family of the dead girl. And then you have the parents of the dead girl. You have Bob and Sally Dowler, and you've got her sister, Gemma. And they're essentially there, and they are the lawyer for the Dowlers basically says, I know you know about me, but I know about you too. And it's a very interesting way that he starts, because actually the News of the World's lawyers had paid people to follow him to see if they could get damning information about him, just as a lawyer to discredit him, which tells you their mindset there, the punitiveness and the sort of the lengths to which they're willing to go to fight. But he says, I know you know about me. I know about you too. And he says to Murdoch, you know, your mother would be ashamed. And his mother, Dame Elizabeth Murdoch, is a woman who was perhaps the most beloved woman in all of Australia. She was by far the greatest benefactor of his home city of Melbourne, the second largest city in Australia. You know, when I went around Melbourne, they'd say, here's the Dame Elizabeth wing of this hospital. Here's this school. Here's this college. Here's this, you know, orphanage. Here's this cancer center. It's just extraordinary going around there. And she also had talked publicly at one point, being asked about Murdoch. She said, you know, people come up to me and say, you know, Rupert's such a wonderful man. He's made so much money. You must be very proud of him. And she says, no, it's what you do with the money and with that power that you know, enables you to be proud of someone. And it was essentially a publicly delivered rebuke to Murdoch in a documentary about his life delivered by his own mother. And Murdoch takes that moment. And he puts his head in his hands and he says, you know, my father would be ashamed. And he always returns to his father as the underappreciated journalist. And he says, you know, he never got his due, my father. He never got his due. He would be ashamed of what happened. And then, you know, Gemma says, you know, essentially says, this isn't enough. You know, you've got to figure out what you can do to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again. And you have Murdoch in this moment, you know, you have a billionaire who thinks he's the outsider, but he's a billionaire whom aspiring prime ministers fly thousands of miles to essentially kiss the ring of. And he's being confronted in a way that he almost never is by the people who have no entry into power or the press, who have no experience in dealing with handlers, and who are just there by virtue of their daughter and sister having been killed and been fodder for his tabloids headlines. And he is having to endure the repercussions and see the real-world reactions of this. And he puts his head in his hands and he just says, I'm sorry. I'm just so sorry. Very human moment for a guy who seems above the human touch.
Rupert Murdoch agrees in the wake of all of this to sever the newspaper side of his empire from the entertainment side. And it's interesting you mentioned just how much his business decisions have been, as you put it in your book, structured around the psychology of his kids. Talk a little bit about that, because it's interesting. You mentioned his eldest son, Lachlan, refused to return to News Corp. He had left kind of in a huff. And a lot of his decisions are influenced by his relationship or dysfunctional relationship with his kids.
I think that's exactly right. You know, Lachlan had been tapped as the kid who was going to be the next Murdoch. He's the older of the two sons. And Murdoch really thinks of the sons as the ones who will succeed him, even right. though his daughter Elizabeth has proven in many ways quite capable. But there's this story about Murdoch where when he was about 5 years old, his mother, who's the beloved, you know, matriarch of Australia, as I've said, but, you know, she was actually pretty tough. She was the disciplinarian. His father, who was a much older guy, was always very indulgent. And so there's a story about young Murdoch at the age of five. She throws him into the deep end of a swimming pool on an ocean liner at sea to teach him how to swim in not very warm waters. And as he's shrieking for one of the attendants to come get him, she forbids them to enter the pool. And she says he's going to have to learn how to swim on his own. Well, Lachlan Murdoch was over the New York Post at one point. He was the head of that, and he was given a bunch of properties to oversee and then elevated to this odd position. I think it was called then, as it is now, Deputy Chief Operating Officer, which is a position that no one's ever heard of anywhere else. But it's really for, you know, the Murdoch son to be right under, you know, the number two person at the company, which is always the non-Murdoch. And at that time was Peter Chernin, a very successful president of News Corp and helped oversee Fox. And Chernin and Roger Ailes essentially played a bunch of political games, by Lachlan's way of thinking, to undermine him, to undercut him, so that it would be very clear that even if he ever succeeded his father, which he felt they were trying to ensure would never happen, that that he would be undermined in a great way. And so he decided to go back home to Australia. He was given a payout, as were some of the other kids, after their new half-sisters by Murdoch's third wife, Wendy, were cut in on some of the fortune. And so he took his hundreds of millions, went back to Australia, basically embraced his Australian identity and stayed down there. Murdoch split the company kind of under duress from his family, from his executives, and from shareholders. And although he controls, with along with the family, so much of the stock, he can't be over outvoted, essentially, on the floor of shareholder meetings. Nonetheless, you know, he wants to make sure that the stock doesn't lose value despite losing many hundreds of millions of dollars so far in cost of the hacking scandal and just having been distracted by this. He decides to split. He splits it up. And the new News Corp, which is split, slimmed down, is constituted of the newspapers, HarperCollins, the publishing house, an educational software division that they're investing a lot of money in and hoping down the line starts to make some profits, and essentially all of the Australian properties. Now, that includes television and cable holdings down there and other digital elements. The incredible thing about it is he says, well, you know, we're doing that basically in part to subsidize some of the fading fortunes of the newspapers. But we're doing it also because of the time zone element, because, you know, gosh, we've got all these newspapers in Australia. It would make no sense to have to deal with the time zone split and put these with Fox News and, you know, the Fox Network and B-Sky B in the UK, which is a huge private broadcasting and satellite company. But actually, that makes no sense. I mean, Murdoch has enormous holdings in satellite TV in India and significant investments in China. And, you know, they're in no way restructuring it so those which align much more closely to the Australian time zone, you know, would be in sync. What they're really doing is constructing a company because he wanted desperately for Lachlan to return to the fold. He wanted Lachlan to be the new CEO of that new slimmed down company. And yes, he could get his son, now that James's chances seem to have been exploded by the scandal in England, he could get Lachlan back in. And Lachlan decides he just doesn't want to do it. Mm. You know, Chase Carey, who's Murdoch's number two, you know, he didn't feel any more confident about. Roger Ailes has just been given a four-year contract that will extend him till he's 77 years old. And he's only stronger as the fates and the profits of Fox have only grown over the years and looked to be, you know, so powerful. He just felt, this can't be for me. And yet, you know, Murdoch so much wanted Lachlan back.
You mentioned that McTaggart lecture that that Rupert Murdoch gives in 1989. Well, his daughter, Elizabeth, you referred to, she gives the lecture in the summer of 2012. And she, what's extraordinary about this lecture is she quotes a man, as you say in the book, who had been pretty vicious about criticizing her father. And I guess in some way, jaws just kind of dropped because really she kind of went about rejecting some of these values that had been attributed to her father, as you put it in the book. This must have been a blow for Rupert Murdoch.
Yeah, you know, I mean, she really presented herself as the, in some ways, the anti-Murdoch Murdoch or the anti-Rupert. You know, she was, you mentioned about how he makes business decisions in this very publicly traded company, but based on his own personal desires. He bought, or he had News Corp bought her production company Shine for, I think it was around $670 million. Every outside analyst I talked to said that was a wildly inflated price. A good production company, well run, but not at that price. And he didn't even really mask why he was doing it. As he announced it, he said it was to get Elizabeth back into the company, which, you know, presumably he could hire her away, pay her a job. But he bought her company to do it. She walked away with about almost $250 million so that her father could bring her back in. She was then poised to take a seat on the board along with her brothers, Lachlan and James. This was in early 2011, and yet she held off a little bit. And as she watched the storm clouds gather, you know, in 2011 and realizing that, you know, there were announcements of settlements towards these other figures, these celebrities and these politicians, you know, she was about to do it in summer of 2011. And then the Millie Dowler thing erupted and she decided not to join the board. A strong signal she was sending distancing herself. She then a year later gives the McTaggart talk. And she directly contrasts herself with her father and her brother James, who had given it a couple of years earlier, by saying, "I embrace the BBC," which her father had always resented and targeted for criticism. And if you follow his Twitter feed like I do obsessively, he still does target it. And her brother James, who had essentially said, "This is something that has to stop. It is thwarting private, private enterprise in the media sphere." And she says, "You know, this is an area in which, you know, we can collaborate and we can coexist and make one another stronger." And she singled out for praise the late Dennis Potter, a well-known screenwriter and television writer who's very acerbic and critical of Murdoch. When he had a malignant tumor diagnosed, he named the tumor Rupert. You know, and she says, I respect the creativity represented by Dennis Potter. And it was a signal that she was saying, "I'm my own person. I'm a different brand of Murdoch." And if there's anybody who can lead News Corp or the Murdoch empire in a way that suggests a break from the past, she would probably be the one.
David Folkenflik, are you back on the blacklist at in the Murdoch enterprise? Do you know?
Let's put it this way. I haven't even gotten in recent weeks the response back saying no comment to my request. So it may well be. I may be on the no list. I'm not sure. I hope to find out. I'll happily share it when I am.
Okay. Let me ask you this finally. I suppose an obvious question is whether Rupert Murdoch is feeling any kind of regret these days about the direction he's taken in his empire or his influence on, you know, global media culture. You say in the book, finally, he's not really given to much self-reflection. He just sort of chooses a path and then sets off. I guess you can't really sense whether or not he feels any kind of regret or any tinge of regret.
I think there are moments when he feels regret around his children. He genuinely loves him. They genuinely love them, love him. And yet it's a very complicated relationship with a lot of feelings of betrayal and mistrust. He is not conditioned to dwell on his own actions and how he could have done things differently. He likes to press forward. He likes to envision new horizons. And he likes to blame critics and slash out at enemies as a way of kind of dispatching those demons. What he's done in splitting the companies is he said, "Okay, guys, you think we should do things differently? I'm going to split off the newspapers so that it's not going to infect the more profitable enterprise." And, in the meantime, he hopes to prove everyone wrong by finding a new way to make fortunes for newspapers in a tough age.
David Folkenflik, his book is Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires, joined us from NPR Studios in New York City. David, thank you very much for the time.
Hey, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.